Okay. As you see, Alan, he prepared the skeleton of the deck, and he crossed his name out for tonight because he is elsewhere. So I'm pulling double duty on it. So we'll get started. If I can get my controls to work. There we go. So on trusting and not trusting Microsoft, this is a really interesting video from Ask Leo, Leo Notenbaum, addressing the idea about whether you should trust Microsoft. And a lot of people might just laugh at that and say, of course not. But he was addressing a particular thing. You know, he said that people were concerned about using OneDrive to store their files, including backups or just for any purpose, because they figured it would allow Microsoft to snoop on any of your documents. And while that technically is true, you know, anyone concerned Microsoft may be doing that should probably watch that video, because really what he comes down to is, well, they wrote Windows. So if they really wanted to snoop on your documents, really doesn't matter where those documents lie, whether they're on OneDrive or whether they're on your local hard drive. They would have the same capability to invade your privacy and do whatever nefarious things they wanted to do. So that is basically his conclusion. But I think that he goes about it with a very reasoned sort of thing. So take a look at the video if you're interested in that. This just came out yesterday. The latest feature update for Windows 11 was just released yesterday. And so this is going to be 25H2. The full blog posting, and this blog posting is the IT Pro blog, which is a little bit different than most consumers are interested in that these are people who are deploying Windows to a large number of computers and so forth. But the basic ideas are there on the fact that it has been released and so forth. So anyone who whose computer meets the requirements can download it right away if you want. And the details on how to do that are in that URL. Now, I would suggest that most people probably don't want to do that, because if you do it through this means, it is basically doing like a full install of Windows 11. You'd be better off waiting for it to become available through Windows Update. And the reason for is if you are on 24H2, which probably most people are, the upgrade time is going to be really, really short. It'll be basically the same time it takes for a regular monthly update to happen. They're delivering it as what they call a minor enablement package update. And in actual fact, they say that most of the new features are already on your computer, but they're just inactive. And so this is just going to turn on those new features. So it should be a very, very easy upgrade, very likely to go extremely smoothly as long as you're on 24H2. If you're on a prior release to 24H2, it will be a bigger deal to do the update, and it will take a longer time. Any questions we have on that, Bob?
No, it's going pretty quiet there.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, now we have a presentation from Tristan on Docker and all about containers. So I will stop my share, and Tristan, you can go ahead and share your screen and take it away.
All right. Hopefully you can see it good.
Yes, we do.
Excellent. So to start, containers are a form of virtualization, but unlike virtual servers, which require a separate, an entire operating system for each virtual server, a container instead shares the host machine's OS kernel. So the container itself is effectively going to contain just the application and its dependencies, nothing else. And the most common container engines, these are the components which are going to run and manage the containers on your system. The most common are Docker and Podman. Currently, the most prevalent one being Docker, which I'm sure you've all heard of. And it's going to have the most examples and documentation that you can find online. some of the advantages that containers will give you are portability and consistency. Since that container contains an application and all its dependencies, it can go on any machine. You can move it from one machine to another, and it's going to behave exactly the same. You don't have to worry about missing dependencies or any of that sort of issues you might encounter on a traditional VM. And because it only contains those components and shares the OS kernel, it has much higher resource efficiency. As an example, currently at home, I'm running 28 containers on a laptop class CPU, and it's using about 10% of the total CPU. If I was to do that same thing with 28 VMs, that machine would be on its knees, basically. And another little advantage is that you're also only going to have one operating system to maintain and do updates on, and that's going to be your host operating system. You'll, of course, still need to update the containers, but that is a much simpler process. Both VMs and containers both provide isolation between different applications and the host system. Containers, however, can be a bit more secure as they generally only contain the minimum software possible to run that given application. Thus, it reduces the potential attack vectors. A container's data by default is ephemeral, so it's only going to exist as long as that container is running. If you wish to store persistent data with that application, which in most cases you will, a storage volume external to the container gets mapped to it, and Docker has two methods to achieve this. That's going to be bind mounts or Docker volumes. The Docker volumes are managed by Docker, and they're stored in a specific Docker directory on your host machine. Bind mounts, on the other hand, are going to be a directory on your host again, but it can be anywhere you choose on the host, and that directory is then going to be mounted into the container for you to store your data. In both of those cases, the storage volume lifecycle is managed independent of the container's lifecycle. And but choosing between the two, personally, I prefer bind mounts for a home environment because that still gives you direct access to the files for things such as migrations and backups. It's a little easier to handle. In order to deploy containers with Docker, that has two potential methods as well. You can use the Docker commands directly, which is going to be a heck of a lot of typing for you to do every time you want to run the container. Or you can use the composed file, and this is a YAML type file. And within that file, you define your configuration for your container. And you can take that file and save it in source control, say GitHub, for example, or just a file on your machine. And you can move that file to another machine and fire up that container just as easily. So it gives you a little more reproducibility.
Just before you go on, we have a question. What's YAML?
YAML is just a... I can't remember what the acronym means off the top of my head, but it's effectively just a text type format file. Similar, if you know what JSON is, it's somewhat similar.
So sort of like a script, really?
Yeah, it's just a data definition file, like XML or JSON or many others. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll look up what the acronym means, though, later. I just put a note here as well that if you do save such files onto something like GitHub, just be careful in a public repository not to put your passwords, please. And speaking of those compose YAML files, here's an example here for you. On the right-hand side here is just the comments I put to describe what all these options are. But this is the definition of our container configuration. In this section here, we are creating or defining a new Docker network, because in Docker, you can create as many network virtual kind of networks that you want, or if you don't define one, it's just going to go on the default Docker network, which doesn't really give you the security separation you'd want. So normally you'd create a network for each container. And anything within that container can talk to each other. In this case, I'm just doing a single container. We start by putting this services tag, and everything below that is going to be container definition. You can have multiple containers in the file or just one. It's up to you. In some cases, you may have the front-end application and its matching database. For my example, I'm using Forgeo, which is a Git system similar to GitHub. It's just open source. So this server definition, you could actually, this is just my container identifier, so to speak. That can be any name you choose. Then I specify the image source that I'm going to pull it down from. This is from the vendor of that software. A display name that's going to be seen within Docker. And then we have these environment variables, which are going to be different for each container. That's usually to do customizations of the software itself. This restart always command, that's just to tell it what's going to happen if, say, the machine loses power when it comes back online and Docker restarts. This one specifies the container will automatically start itself. Here I just joined the container to the network I previously created. And here with the volumes, I'm specifying that bind mount to store the data and passing in a read-only fashion the time zone information of the host, just so that the container can adopt that as well. These ports I specify are the ports for the application, and those are going to be exposed to the outside so that you can access the container. For the demo, I'm just gonna go through slides showing how to actually spin up that container that I went through that compose file example for. For the demo, I started with a brand new installation of the Debian Linux operating system for my host. To install Docker, the official documentation site has nice step-by-step instructions to get you started for multiple Linux distros. It's just basically a copy-paste of their command to do the installation, and you're off to the races. Here I add my user account. In this case, I called it a demo to the Docker group. That allows me to issue the Docker commands without having to do sudo every time on Linux. For the directory structure on my host, I then create the location where I'm going to store my data. Normally, I do it on the SRV location, create this containers folder, and then I make another subfolder for every container that I'm going to run. My compose file will live in that directory, and then this data subdirectory is where the data for the application itself is going to be stored. I then quickly make sure to give the account I'm running under ownership on all those directories. and just did an ls just to verify and validate everything looks good. Now it's a good idea also for the account you're running under to just do this ID command to verify what the ID of the account is, because that is going to be utilized in most of your Compose files. I then open up a text editor, creating that compose.yaml file in my specified directory. In this case, I use the Nano text editor. Then I pasted in that Docker Compose file from our example. And this example actually came straight from the vendor site. And then all I had to do was add in the custom network that I wanted and add in my bind mount information. At this stage, we're ready to go. To start up this container, all I have to do is run this command, docker compose up -d. What this -d means is to execute the container in a detached mode. That means it's just going to run in the background on your host machine. At that stage, it pulls down the container from the vendor source. You may notice all these ID numbers here. Those are actually SHA-256 hashes for each of the read-only layers that make up the image. So it's just pulling all those down, creates and starts the network, and starts up that container. That whole startup process took about 7 seconds. And now, to access the application, all I have to do is open my web browser, go to the IP address of the host machine, specify that port that was defined in the compose file for the application, and here I am in the application. In this case, when it's first used, the application wants you to set up an admin account, so I do that. And here I'm in the application as fully functional and ready to use. Now you may notice it says here not secure. That's just because I have not specified a certificate for this application at this time. And you can actually get rid of the IP address and ports values as well if you're using something called a reverse proxy. Then you could use your own custom domain name, get a certificate from Let's Encrypt, and have it all beautiful. That's a little bit beyond the scope of this little demo, though. But just so you're aware, that to do that, it would be called a reverse proxy, which you can operate in yet another container. When a new version of that application does come along, all you have to do is this Docker Compose pull, and that'll go grab the new version of the container, then another Docker Compose up-d, and is going to replace the existing container with the new version of it, and your upgrade is complete in roughly about another 7 seconds. And that's all you have to do. No next to install or any of that good stuff. In order to get container images, a lot of the open source web-based applications, they have container images already pre-built for you, available on Docker Hub or their own vendor sites. And they often also provide Docker Compose templates, so that you basically just cut and paste and update a few parameters and you're ready to go. Another excellent source is linuxserver.io. They create containers for many open source project softwares that can do a multitude of things. They have hundreds of them. I haven't even explored a fraction of them. A few examples to give you some ideas of containers I found useful at home. There's one called Portainer. It actually provides a GUI for managing containers. So a container to manage containers. Jellyfin, which provides you streaming of TV shows, movies, and music, kind of like your own personal Netflix, effectively. Image, which is a photo management software, similar to like a Google Photo or Amazon Photo. Mealy, a recipe manager, Home Assistant, that's a neat one. You can use that to program your to have a system to, say, open your garage door with your phone or control the lights in your house, your thermostat, whatever you want. You imagine it, you can do it with that software. Nginx Proxy Manager, that's a GUI-based reverse proxy, very easy to use and manage if you did want to use a custom domain and certificates. There's also Authentic, which gives you an identity provider and single sign-on services so that you can securely connect to all your containers and applications with a single password. Personally, I found experimenting with containers just opens this whole world called self-hosting. And there's actually a large and growing community around that who are looking to take back control of their personal data so it's not sitting with Google or Microsoft or any of those big players. It's often called de-Googling. The self-hosting containers can be a great learning experience and a fun hobby. And it also is a great way to give a second life to as a home server to any old PC you might have lying around the house. And, of course, this was just a quick little demonstration to give you a little taste of it. If you were interested in exploring deeper, this Guru Computing blog has an excellent walkthrough guide on setting up a rather advanced setup with reverse proxies, storing your own Docker Compose files in Git on your own container again, and security, backups, the whole deal. It's an excellent article. There's also a few YouTubers such as Techno Tim, Christian Lempa, and Jim's Garage that have excellent content on containers and applications that you can self-host at home. And with that, that completes the little demo and a brief overview of Docker. If anyone has any questions, feel free to chime in.
There was a comment, Tristan, about the advantage of a container versus an exe file. I don't know a bit about myself at all.
Well, between an exe, that's just going to run on whatever machine you put that exe on, right? The main difference, well, containers primarily are going to be used for web-based applications. Oh, I'll just give me a second here. Cool. I'll just stop sharing if I can find it here.
Very neat.
And we also had Richard answered the question about what is YAML with a link to Wikipedia article on YAML. So I still don't know what it stands for, but you can, if you want more information, you can look it up on Wikipedia. It's in the chat.
It stands for yet another markup language.
Okay. Yeah. That makes sense, I guess.
But it's evolved. So now it means YAML ain't a markup language.
Okay.
So effectively, there were, in computing lately, we've had kind of three stages where everything was running on a big server or your local machine. Then it took the next step where you would, to give you some isolation and hardware sharing, you'd go to virtual servers, they all required their own OS. So now this third stage is just virtualizing the application itself without all the extra baggage. I guess
one of the big benefits of running a container would be that it is in an isolated environment, so it's not going to interfere with other things, and other things aren't going to interfere with it.
Yeah, you can get quite advanced, like with that networking component. You can have each container separate and then, say, have this reverse proxy thing, but only it can connect to all those containers, and now I just have one thing to connect into my server, this reverse proxy, and it directs the traffic to each container, whatever I want to access. It kind of works as the traffic director, so to speak.
And Microsoft at one point came out with something for virtualization for applications, which I guess is quite similar to containers, if not identical. Identical, I guess, in concept. But I don't know whatever happened to that. I heard about it probably 10 years ago, and that was the last I've heard.
Yeah, I think it just got overtaken by Docker and the more standardized approaches that came in. Because Docker and all these virtualization things, which you maybe heard about, Kubernetes and so on, they all use a standardized containerized system. Microsoft, of course, was working for a proprietary one, but the open one won out in that case.
Yeah, Microsoft loves standards as long as it's theirs. Okay, thanks a lot there, Tristan. That was an interesting overview of what it was all about. So we'll go back to the sharing, and we'll continue on. Okay, so this was a question that came in from Carol Pearson, and I titled it, Am I Inviting More Junk Mail? So she said that she recently changed ISPs, and she all of a sudden was seeing more junk mail in her mailbox. And she wondered if marking something as phishing or junk, it seems to get even more of the emails. And is she actually causing more junk mail on that? Now, before I go on, I will say that I often talk like I know what I'm talking about. And this one is sort of like that. I know some things about it, but if other people are more knowledgeable about it, please chime in. So, I think the short answer is no, that you're not going to be inviting more spam just by marking something as being junk mail or anything like that in most email interfaces. So either a web-based email client or a local client software, something like Thunderbird or something like that. When you mark something as being spam, junk, or phishing or anything like that, it should not actually send anything to the originator. And that's the only thing that should really cause more stuff to come in, is if the originator sees that, oh, you're actually reacting to this, so they'll send you more. So let's just take a step back and look at what spam filtering really does. There's a couple of possibilities. What you can do from a very blunt instrument point of view, you could say block future emails from that sender, or block emails with that subject line, or a word in the subject line, or something like that. Very much a blunt instrument. More sophisticated, you can use Bayesian filtering to block future emails. So you do it locally with a mail client like Thunderbird, which has Bayesian filtering built in, or it can be done at the email service provider, such as Gmail or Outlook.com. Now, theirs is much more sophisticated, I think, than a standard Bayesian filter. So what is Bayesian filtering? It's a statistical technique where it looks at all your email, and basically you tell it what is good mail and what is bad mail. And then it does an analysis on new mail coming in to see whether it thinks that it actually is spam or legitimate email. You have to train it. Okay? So you give it a list of spam and a list of, they call ham, legitimate emails. And then it builds up that knowledge base of what is bad and what is good. When a new email arrives, it checks for the presence and frequency of those characteristics that you've trained it on, and it tries to figure out whether something is spam or not. If you're interested in this, Paul Graham was the first guy that I know of who came out with this document, A Plan for Spam, and it was all about using Bayesian filtering. And I think it dates back to about 2002 or something like that. So it's been around a long time. And there's a Perplexity link there as well that talks about what Bayesian filtering is, how it works, and that sort of thing, if you care to get more information on that. So is blocking spam actually worth the effort? So all the mail clients have an ability to say, you know, this is spam or this is, you know, or is it bad email that you want blocked in the future? Well, maybe, maybe not. So I think the blunt instrument blocking is probably not worth it because, first off, spammers tend not to send from the same email address multiple times because they know the people are going to be blocking based on an email address, so they'll just choose another email address. Real easy to spoof email addresses. So it's unlikely that any new spam coming in will be from, you know, ostensibly the same sender, the same subject, things like that. Bayesian filtering, more likely to be able to help because it is a statistical analysis on emails. Major email providers actually have very sophisticated spam filtering. This is a report that Google put out. Their defense is stopping more than 99.9% of spam, phishing, and malware from reaching inboxes and blocks nearly 15 billion unwanted emails every day. That's pretty phenomenal. So a couple of things you should never do. Reply to a spammer. First off, the reply address is probably spoofed anyways because they don't want to be blamed and kicked off their ISP or anything like that about all the spam. So they'll just spoof somebody else's email address, whether it exists or not. Don't use links in the spam to unsubscribe for anything. That tells the spammer two things. First, that your email address is actually a valid email address and that you read their spam to the extent that you got to the point where you could click on an unsubscribe. So both of those could definitely lead to more spam. Anybody else have any other thoughts on this topic? Because as I said, I've dealt a lot with email, but I don't consider myself to be an expert on email. So if anybody else has any thoughts, feel free to chime in. Yeah, Tom?
I use a Bayesian filter to filter all my email coming in from any email address because I use several. And it's a sort of a filter. It's called Popfile. It's been it hasn't been in development for the last few years, but it works fine. It works for me. It serves as a kind of a intermediary between me and my email providers, and it brings down the email itself, and then it uses a Bayesian classifier. And you teach the Bayesian classifiers to what you want it to classify as. And for example, I have a virus classification. I have a spam classification. I think I have a financial spam classification because there used to be a lot of those. And then I have a whole bunch of other classifications that lead to things like images and bicycling and other interests of mine. And so it actually sorts them out into all this, and it then you can put a little addition in the header that it gives to the email program you have. I use Pegasus, but you could use Outlook or any other or Thunderbird. So it creates its own header, but you can also put stuff in the subject line, which you can then filter into different folders and so on. So all it does is it looks at it. It classifies it and either puts a header into the email that specifies what bucket it's chosen. And optionally, it can put something into the subject line. So if you do keep your own mail on your own machine rather than leaving it in the web, you can really set up your own filtering mechanism that will allow you to filter into a variety of categories. I think I have 30 categories. I have 26 for the alphabet. I use the alphabet and then the extra 10 numbers to actually classify because it makes it simpler to choose buckets and so on.
That's cool. Could you paste information into the chat about that?
I have.
Oh, okay, thanks. That's pretty cool. Thanks very much. Anybody else have anything to add before we move on?
Okay, you need to occasionally look at your junk or spam email folder is occasionally a genuine email will get marked as spam.
Yeah, true. Yeah, that's a good point. I find that Gmail does a very good job of classifying, but even it has on occasion marked something as spam. I find that Thunderbird has quite often miscategorized something as being, well, I wouldn't say often, but more often than Gmail has miscategorized things. So, yeah, that's a good point. Always check your spam folder periodically before they expire automatically, because most mail programs, including things like Gmail, if it's in the spam folder for 30 days, it disappears completely. Okay, thanks very much. Okay, let's move on. And we now have a share from Mr. Bob Harris on everything. He's going to talk to us about everything. Take it away, Bob.
Very good. Thank you, Chris. Yes, I'm Bob Harris, and today I'd like to share something with you that'll change your file finding.
Oh, sorry. I guess I had builds on those items.
Okay. There we go. Okay.
Yeah.
It'll change your file finding forever. The holy grail of file finding here. Now, we all have this problem. Every computer has files. Every user wants to find their files. Windows search should be easy, but it's not. Who here has spent more than 5 minutes trying to find a file you know is there? Well, anyway, I used to think it was me, but anyway, having a problem with the slides. There we go. So the harsh truth about Windows file search, it's not that good. It takes forever to find things. It sometimes actually misses files you know are there. It uses tons of resources. It bogs down your system. And I used to think it was me, but really it's not. The problem is the Windows file search. And of course, yes, you could optimize your Windows search, but it requires a computer science degree and the willingness to risk breaking your entire system. I tried that once, and my computer wouldn't speak to me for a week. Anyway. So, I wanted to find a better file search, and so began my epic search for a better search solution. Well, I searched for the holy grail of file searches. I searched the entire World Wide Web. I tried everything. As it turns out, the answer was much closer than I had thought. And I found it on page 7 of our own October 2011 newsletter. Yes, I learned that sometimes the best treasures are often hiding in plain sight. As soon as I saw it, I knew I had struck gold. Yes, there it is. And yes, here it is now. On the front page from 2011, we had Chris Taylor had a great article about the Wondershare Live Boot coming up next year in 2012. And on page 2, the Microsoft MVP program had just offered the club a prize for a raffle. It was a complete copy of Windows 7 Ultimate, valued at $350. And then continuing on, finally, to page 7, the OPC-UG free software guide compiled by Alan German, Duncan Petrie, and Bryce Whiteman. There it is. And yes, these three visionaries, Alan, Duncan, and Bryce, weren't just recommending the best software of the day. They were looking into a crystal ball, and they had found gold. And there it says here, everything. With this file indexing utility, you can search disks using logical operands. You can use the asterisk and the question mark. The program will locate files and folders by name instantly. You can, with a bit of configuration, you can even search across an entire home network, and there it was at that time, version 1.2.1.371 from Void Tools. Imagine that. So, I'd like you to meet everything. And here we are today, few years later, the current version is 1.4.1.1028. And this is a very tiny program, 1.5 megabytes for the entire program. For size, doesn't matter when you're this good. It still remain instant file finding. This was created by David Carpenter, a fellow from Australia, discovered by Alan German, Duncan Petrie, and Bryce Whiteman. Amazing stuff. So you may ask, how does everything achieve the impossible? Well, it's not magic. Everything reads your computer master file table, like a giant phone book. But the best part is that everything provides the results to you instantaneously, without slowing down your system. It doesn't matter if you have a new computer or an old one with no RAM at all. It runs easy and instant. It's beyond, the speed is beyond you can imagine. You type one character, it's there. It's faster than I can type. So we have comparison here. A big showdown in the Windows search takes forever, does miss some files, eats resources, and everything finds files in much less than one second. It's invisible to their system. Can't say it enough. Lightning speed results instantaneously. Nothing can be faster. You can type, it's there. Bang, bang, bang. So let's take a look at it. This is everything. Looks pretty simple. Don't get worried here now. How do you search for a file? Just type what you want in that little search bar. If you're a beginner, you don't need to be afraid of this one. I don't bother much with the menus up on top, but you can go to that way too if you want. It shows you the results amazingly fast. It doesn't matter if you're a beginner. It's for everybody. It's simple enough to use. If you want to get a little fancy, you can use the asterisk command to help find your files a little faster. That's an optional thing. You don't have to do this. But the asterisk is a universal wildcard command. If you want to find all your PDF files, you put asterisk.pdf, find PDFs and all that. So whether you're just starting out or you want to use advanced filter like the real pros do, everything is for everyone. It's simple, powerful, but the key is it's always lightning fast. And yes, everything is so lightweight, take it with you. That's true. It's so small, you can run everything on the tiniest thumb drive. There's no installation is required. You pop this on a thumb drive. Run it from your thumb drive. You can plug it into a laptop. You can find the files on that laptop or another PC. This is great for service calls and diagnostics. It's fantastic. Now, I like triple solutions. So once I find something I like, I pin it to my taskbar. So I never ever have to find it again. So once you get this or any program open, right mouse click on that program icon and select pin to taskbar. This is a screenshot of my taskbar when nothing is running. Want to stress that. This is my taskbar when nothing is running. My taskbar is not blank. My icons are already there, ready to jump into action. So I suggest you put everything on your taskbar because using a search tool shouldn't require searching. Now let's give credit where credit is due. These three gentlemen didn't just recommend software. They changed computing lives of so many people. Alan German, Duncan Petrie, Bryce Whiteman have been contributing since 2011 and well before that. These visionaries recognize tomorrow's tools today and their dedication it's helped make the OPCUG legendary for well over 40 years. So thank you to these folks and all others that contribute to the OPCUG. It's a sharing community, and your efforts are appreciated. So there you have it, folks. Everything from Void Tools. Everything is still an essential tool today. You should have it on every computer. You go to the Void Tools website. It's free there. I would suggest most computers now, almost all of them are 64-bit. You grab that one, The one below that is the portable version for your service calls on your thumb drive. There's no ads. They do accept donations. And thank you to the people that found this many years ago. It's still a solid find. Cool stuff, easy to run.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Okay, just going back a little bit, I'm just looking at the chat now and going back to spam blocking and that. We did have comments from some people to that they actually did unsubscribe from newsletters, unwanted newsletters. If you trust the email that is coming in, that it's a legitimate company, they should honor unsubscribes. It's when you get spam that I wouldn't try unsubscribing from. And Harvey says, on a more serious spam, I contact the SMTP provider with the email and header information for them to track down the culprit. And you're willing to spend more time than I am on a spammer. I'm not saying it's a bad thing to do, but at any rate, let's just see what else we have. So the download link is in the chat for everything. And I think, yeah, basically that's it. Okay. So thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you.
And we will continue on. So
the equivalent of everything that runs on Linux.
I do not know at all. Does anybody in the Linux community know if there's an equivalent to everything in the Linux environment?
I do not know.
Yeah. If anybody has an idea, plug it into the chat. Okay, I have a recap on the Windows Consumer Extended Security Updates. This seems to be rolling out really aggressively now to everybody, which is probably a good thing, seeing as the end of life is in less than 2 weeks. Just a reminder, the end of life is October 14th, after which there will be no more security updates. They haven't had feature updates for quite a while, but there will be no more security updates, and that's all I really care about with an operating system. So they are available, and the extended security updates, and it will extend your updates for an extra year until October 13th of 2026. So there's three options. One is US $30, or there's two no-dollar costs. You can configure Windows to back up settings to OneDrive in the cloud. An important note here, you don't have to back up your files to OneDrive. Some people think when it talks about backing up to OneDrive, they think, oh, I don't want all my files in OneDrive, and it's going to fill OneDrive and things like that. All you have to do is back up settings. You don't even have to back up all your settings. You could just choose accessibility settings or something like that. Back them up to the cloud, and that'll work perfectly well to make it enabled. Or you can spend 1,000 Microsoft reward points. And we've talked about that previously, about how you get reward points and things like that. So some of the prerequisites for the consumer extended security updates. You have to be on Windows 10 version 22H2, which hopefully everybody will be on. You have to have the latest updates installed. So just make sure you go to Windows Update and check for updates. You have to use a Microsoft account used to sign into the computer, must be an administrator. And so you will need to have a Microsoft account either to cash in points or to back up your computer settings to the cloud. You're going to have a Microsoft account anyways. So you can go to Settings, Accounts, Your Info, and look for administrator underneath your profile picture. And if you are signed in using a local account, you can still do it, but you'll be prompted to provide credentials for a Microsoft account during the process. So here it is for backing up settings to OneDrive. So if I go in, I can see that my Microsoft account shows there, so I know that I'm using a Microsoft account. And then I go to Settings, Accounts, Windows Backup, and then that's where I can toggle it on. So, again, you don't have to sync everything. So, for example, you could toggle it on and then just make sure you only toggle on accessibility or something like that, or personalization, whatever you want. You can toggle on one of them, and that will enable it. So then you'll go back to the main Windows Update screen. You should be getting this without the yellow. I just put the yellow block on here to highlight it for this presentation. But you should see that you can enroll in extended security updates to help keep your device secure, and you'll have a link to enroll now. So you just click on that, and if you don't see that, just check back later, They're rolling it out quite quickly. And then you'll get a screen just explaining what's going to happen. You click on next, and then it tells me that, oh, I'm already backing up my Windows settings, and so therefore I'm eligible right away. I don't have to do anything else. Now, the odd thing about this is this happened on every Windows 10 computer that I've had access to, and I swear that on three of these computers, I never turned on backing up settings to the cloud. So I think Microsoft was turning that on automatically when you use a Microsoft account. I can't swear by it, but as I said, and everybody I've talked to has gotten this screen saying, oh, you're already backing up your Windows settings, so you're eligible. So if you don't like the fact that you're backing it up to the cloud, after you enroll, go turn that off. So then it'll come up and it'll say, okay, you're enrolled for security updates through October 13th, 2026. You click on done, and then when you go back to the Windows update screen, you'll see your PC is enrolled to get extended security updates. So you're good to go for another year. And if you're in a narrow view, rather than it being on the side, it'll be below the main options. So once you're enrolled, you don't have to continue backing up your settings. So you can turn it off. It's fine. You'll continue to get security updates. If you switch your account from a local account to a Microsoft account in order to do the enrollment, there's no requirement for it to remain a Microsoft account. So if you want, you can change a Microsoft account to a local account by going to Settings, Accounts, Your Info, sign in with a local account instead. So you're perfectly fine to go ahead with that. I just see Franz, should I click on automatic updates? I think that you're probably talking about, there is a spot where, well, I mean, you're on automatic updates anyways. The one thing that you get as an additional thing is that where you see on the screen now, get the latest updates as soon as they're available. I would not turn that on. That you'll be a guinea pig for Microsoft's monthly updates. Everything that comes through with that option will get sent to you on Patch Tuesday anyways. So personally, I would not turn that on. If you mean something else, then let me know. Okay. I have one more share. So this is something on a YouTube tech. So 7 reasons you could lose your Google account forever. Another Ask Leo one. And this is actually a really good one. Anybody who uses a Gmail, I highly recommend that you take a look at this video. So if you lose access to your Gmail account or your Google account, it means you could lose, you know, all your email, contacts, everything like that, going back years and years, and good luck getting it back. So he says that most recovery failures are caused by pretty simple mistakes, outdated recovery info. So, Google does a pretty good job of trying to convince you to have recovery information, either another email address or a phone number or a bingo card of recovery numbers that you can plug in, one-time passwords, things like that. But if you go and you put in, say, an email address for recovery, and then all of a sudden you find that, oh, I can't get into my Gmail account, so I will just do a recovery. And it goes to an email address, and you go, oh, that's going to an email address that I don't have anymore. Well, you could be dead in the water. So make sure your recovery information is kept up to date. He says also weak and reused passwords, as always, are a bad thing. Ignoring any warnings that come up about your account and things like that. Not enabling two-factor authentication. Google does two-factor authentication very well, and there's a lot of different means you can use for the second factor, and you can have multiple second factors that are available. And there are a few others, so, you know, that highlighted 4 of them. There's another 3 reasons that he has. So if you are interested in making sure that you never lose access to your Gmail, by all means, take a look at Leo's video. Tristan says, so can do the extended Win 10 support, then switch to Windows 11 later when ready. Yeah, if your computer is capable of doing Windows 11. Personally, I would say just go for it now, but if you wanted to wait longer, sure, get the extended updates and then switch to Windows 11 later on. That would be fine. Okay, so avoid those mistakes. Never risk losing your account. So other options for extended security updates. All Windows 10 computers I have access to, as I said, already backing up the settings. So computers were enrolled automatically. I didn't have the choice to actually use Microsoft Points. If you prefer one of the other options, either spending 1,000 Microsoft reward points or US $30, see the video that is on the screen there now, and it goes through all of the options in that. But if you are not already backing up settings to the cloud, you should be given the option to do that, and they will tell you how to do it. Or you can actually spend the 1,000 reward points, and they'll tell you how to go about doing that. I see Tom says running out of Google Search, create a new account. That's right. Google will give you, I think it's 15 gigabytes per account, and you can have as many accounts as you want. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Darlene says, I recently discovered you have too many Google accounts, so be careful as to how many. That's interesting. I didn't know that they could actually tell if you had more than one Google account. That's really interesting. I never knew that. Okay, so we are well into the last 10. So if anybody had anything else they wanted to bring up, questions or information they want to share with others, now's the time. You could unmute yourself or throw it into the chat.
I have a question.
Sure, Tom.
I have a security key. Here it is, a little dongle that lights up, and it's original FIDO key and not a FIDO 2. And it works fine for FIDO things in Chromium and in Chrome and Vivaldi, but it doesn't work fine in Firefox. Firefox doesn't seem to recognize it. I have changed the config to allow it. But it still doesn't get recognized. Does anyone have had this problem and found a solution?
I personally have not heard of anything. If anybody else can chime in if you have any experience with FIDO keys. While we wait for that, Phil says, I'm looking for a photo editor that works on a tablet. Any ideas? I guess one of the things would be, what's the operating system on the tablet? Not that I know of anything that will run on either an Android tablet or iOS from Apple. Android. So if anybody has an idea of a photo editor for Android.
There is a good one. I just can't remember the name, but I can bring it next time.
Okay, thanks. We can also get that posted to the user forum if people don't want to wait 2 weeks for the next. Carol said Snapseed. Is that it?
That's it.
Okay. Snapseed. Thanks, Carol. Okay, so Phil, you can give that a shot. Have you discussed PC Manager in the past? I did a share quite a while ago on PC Manager. We could revive that, I suppose. It's a tuning utility or cleanup utility, I guess, more than anything else, from Microsoft. It first came out of Japan or China in Microsoft, and it is now available in the Microsoft Store. So it's an interesting program. It allows you to drill down pretty deeply into seeing where things are being stored on your PC and how you can do cleanups and things like that. So it has been discussed couple years back, but maybe we'll take a look at reviving that. It hasn't changed much since the first days of it. Tom says Lightroom is good and free. Is that available for Android? It is? Okay.
For a tablet?
Well, Android is Android, so. Well, it should be.
But you'd have to have enough memory and everything. But, well, not for him.
Well, it's an abbreviated version, but they let you do things because they want you to buy the PC version or the Mac version.
Right, okay.
Okay, from Darlene, I have Chris, what do you turn off if you're a person who got the message that you back up your settings, even though you never did set it up? You can just leave it on. You can take a look at those settings and see whether you want to back those up or not. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. Backing up your settings, if you log into multiple computers with the same Microsoft account, it can synchronize those settings across the multiple computers. So whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is your call. And exactly what you want synchronized between those computers is your call. So take a look at the settings that are available and decide, first off, are you logging into multiple computers using the same Microsoft account? If you're not, it has no effect whatsoever. But if you are logging on to multiple devices using the same Microsoft account, then you can have those settings synchronized between the computers. And it looks like Microsoft may have bought out PC Mag. I don't think they ever bought it out. I didn't think so. I thought that they it was almost like the Power Toys, where it was somebody within Microsoft actually created it a number of years ago. Microsoft China, I guess it is, really. I didn't think they had bought it from somebody else. But, yeah, it is available from Microsoft. And Darlene says only log into one device with the account. So it's not going to make any difference if you back up your settings to the cloud or not, if you're only logging into one device. The synchronization is between multiple devices is essentially what it's doing. Okay, so let me just finish up the deck. We are just past the 8:30 mark, so upcoming presentations at the Ottawa Public Library. I'm doing Fun with Fonts at Nepean Centerpoint. Anybody who has to cross town, apparently the Queensway is going to be shut down eastbound to westbound from Friday to Monday or something like that. So you might not want to cross town to come do it, but if you're in the West End, I'll be at Nepean Centerpoint. I have enhancing capabilities and performance with free tools at Richmond out in the South End on Monday. And Linda has one of her armchair travels, beautiful British Columbia at Alta Vista on Thursday, October 9th. And there's more available. There's a total of about still 26 programs, I think, that are still upcoming. So if you use the link at the bottom of the screen or you just go to our website, has all of them listed as well. Reminder that next Wednesday we do not have Q&A, so we will have our regular monthly meeting, and it will be Francis Chow from the Tucson Computer Society is going to be talking to us about Wi-Fi extenders, Wi-Fi routers, and Wi-Fi mesh, and he has some demo stuff. He's going to be able to show exactly how all of this stuff works and what is the difference between extenders and mesh networks and all that sort of thing and how it all comes together. So looking forward to that. So the next Q&A will be October 8th, no meeting on the October 8th, so the next Q&A will be the 15th, and so please send in your questions, answers, everything like that to suggestion box. Alan will be back for that one, and so hopefully things will go a little bit smoother at that meeting. I just noticed a couple of other things in the chat. Ma says, I have a person who created a bunch of filters in Outlook to control spam emails. She recently purchased a new system with new software. How can she transfer her defined filters from the old to the new system? I forget where they actually store that. I'm assuming that this is with Outlook installed on the local computer that she's using. I think there is a way of doing it, but I don't know off the top of my head.
I think Tristan's got something on there, Chris.
Oh, okay.
On the chat.
Open files, choose the export rules. There you go. Thank you very much, Tristan. So, Mal, you can take a look at that. And Tom affirms that, yes, Lightroom is on iOS as well as Android. It is a stripped-down version, but I think it's still pretty capable. And I think that's everything that I see in the chat. If I missed anything, please chime in again. Other than that, I think we are at the end of the meeting. So thanks very much for everybody showing up. Thanks very much for Tristan and Bob for doing shares. If anybody else has their favorite application or something like that, or settings or warnings or anything like that you want to share with the group, by all means, let us know at the suggestion box. Thanks, Carol, for the question that she sent in. And I will see you all next week at the regular monthly meeting and in 2 weeks at the next Q&A.
One question. If we want to make a presentation, how can we outshine Bob? Because he showed us everything.
That's right. I know. Yeah, there's nothing left to share.
Tom, that looked like you as the wizard.
That was Alan. That was Alan Allen.
Bob knows everything.
Alan Driven and Bryce and Duncan.
You stand on the shoulders of greats.
That's true, yes. We all do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good night.
Okay. Thanks, folks.
Thank you, everybody. Good job, Chris. Very smooth.
Thank you.